Today we have a great meeting. I'm very excited to welcome Sarah Pingle from the Education Commission of the States. First, I wanted to thank all of the members for coming here. We're all volunteers, and we definitely appreciate your time. We know how precious the time is, so I want to thank you for that. And just also talk about how important the work we're doing is now. We've seen the issues with the budget. We understand that we're really trying to equitably distribute less and less dollars. So we look forward to hearing from Sarah on how we can hopefully accomplish those goals.
Sure. I was just hoping for the benefit of Sarah that it might be helpful to go around the room so she knows who's represented here. It might be a little insightful. Okay, thank you.
And also, while we aren't being televised, this meeting is being recorded, so please make sure to press your red button when you speak. And if we can start over there with Heather.
Heather Hamilton, Director of Graduate Financial Aid at Quinnipiac University, and I'm also representing CAPFA, our Connecticut Financial Aid Association. For all our professional directors across the state, I'm the president.
Michelle Cochran, I'm the Director of Financial Aid at Albertus Magnus College in New Haven, a small private Catholic school.
I'm Jen Witness. I work with the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges, which represents all the private, nonprofit higher ed institutions in Connecticut.
I'm Julie Savino, Executive Director of University Financial Assistance at Sacred Heart University.
Hi, Mark French. I'm the Director of Student Financial Aid for the State Office of Higher Education.
Good morning. Judy Resnick, Chair of the Planning Commission for Higher Education and retired from CBIA.
Jeanette Weldon, Executive Director of the Connecticut Higher Education Supplemental Loan Authority.
Hi, I'm Greg DeSantis. I'm the Associate Director of Financial Aid from Housatonic Community College and also the Faculty Advisory Committee for the Connecticut State Colleges and Universities.
Good morning. I'm Mona Lucas, Director of Student Financial Aid Services at the University of Connecticut.
Good morning. Wayne Locus, Vice President for Enrollment, University of Connecticut.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Kelly. I'm with the Office of Policy and Management, and I'm a Section Director there overseeing higher education, K-12, and workforce programs.
Good morning. I'm Greg Hedad. I'm the state representative from the 54th District and a member of the Higher Education Committee.
I'm State Representative Roberta Willis. I also am the House Chair of the Higher Education and Employment Advancement Committee. So welcome and thank you.
Thank you. And I'm James Maroney. I'm a member of this committee and a former state representative. And before I turn it over to Sarah, I just wanted to thank you again. She's coming in all the way from Denver to speak for us, and I believe it was through a grant from USA Funds that you were able to do so. So it was at no cost to the state, but we really look forward to your presentation. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to receive the invitation to share this work, this important work, with all of you. I'm just really pleased to be here. So I'm going to start with just a bit of an overview of some of the state financial aid redesign work that ECS has engaged in so far over the last couple of years. And then really I just want to be available to answer your questions about what other states do surrounding state financial aid programs. Over the last couple of years, ECS has spent a lot of time amassing 50 state data on state financial aid programs, and so it would really be just my pleasure to share that out and to answer your questions. So just to start a little bit with who Education Commission of the States is, we at Education Commission of the States believe in the power of learning from experience. And so every day we provide unbiased research and analysis for state policy leaders in order to inform really thoughtful decision-making processes within the states. We do this throughout the education spectrum, from early learning through post-secondary in the workforce. I work as part of the Post-Secondary and Workforce Development Institute within ECS. As was mentioned, you know, we're based out of Denver, and we've been around for about 50 years. The way that we support states is really through four main channels. We author reports, like the financial aid report that I'm presenting on today. We do 50 state research, which is also a main component of this project. We convene our constituents twice per year, every summer, and then also again in December of every year for state policymakers to come together and learn from one another. And we also provide one-on-one council advice, and hopefully that's something that can continue after this meeting today. I'd like to be able to remain a resource to all of you. So today I'm just going to start by going over some national trends in higher education and in state financial aid, and then I'll present our four principles to guide state aid policymaking, which are in the report that you picked up when you came in. We'll talk a little bit about legislative trends in state financial aid programs that happened in 2015, and then I'll leave plenty of time for us to do some questions and discussion. So, long story short, higher education is changing. The students that are being served in higher education today are so different from the students that were served in the 90s, the 80s, even the 70s. So students are more likely to enroll in distance education today. They're more likely to transfer institutions before completing their degree. They're more likely to be less than full-time, attending part-time, working. You know, one in three students has children of their own now in higher education. And higher ed is also serving more students than they have in the past. Many state financial aid programs were designed, most of them in the 70s, a lot of the major programs were. And while there's been kind of tweaks and changes along the way, there's probably larger changes that are needed in order to really update these state financial aid programs to serve the students that are enrolled in higher education today. This graph gives just a snapshot of state support for higher education over the last several years. The red bar represents all support for operations, research, continuing education, and the blue portion is what states have spent on state financial aid over the last several years. And so I think it's just important to note that that state financial aid component is really important, and it's a piece that's really maintained as a pretty consistent fixture across the states in terms of their support for higher education. It tends to fluctuate a little bit less than overall operating support for higher ed. So it's a consistent source of support for students and for institutions. Across the country, this is all inflation-adjusted dollars, state financial aid expenditures have also been on the rise. So from $9.2 billion in 2004 to $11.69 billion 10 years later, states have been increasing their investment. More students are getting more aid than they were 10 years ago across the states as a national trend. This graph represents where Connecticut kind of stands in relation to all of that. So the top line, and I should point out that this includes all state aid provided in Connecticut. So this is governors, this is tuition set-asides, this is everything that Connecticut does in order to compare it to both the New England region and to the United States. So the top red line is total across all of the states, the average state aid program, the middle is Connecticut, and then the bottom is the New England region, the six New England states. So in terms of the New England states, Connecticut is a little bit, you know, above on the higher end of what states have been spending on aid, but certainly, you know, below the national average. You know, there's a few different things to consider when you're looking at just pure dollar data like this, you know, how many students are being served and in what ways. But just to give you an idea of your overall investment relative to other states and regions. There's also been, you know, over the last 5 years, a lot of some change in terms of what states are investing across the states in state financial aid. In most states, it's really just trying to keep that budget consistent. Most states don't make huge wholesale changes in what they're investing from year to year. So you can see over the last 5 years in Connecticut, you've had, you know, a fraction of a percentage decrease in terms of spending on state aid. The U.S. average is a little bit less than that. There are other states that have had larger changes, and I can talk about the states on either end. So in New Hampshire, for example, they relied completely on an older state and federal match program called LEAP or SLEEP, which some of the aid directors in the room may remember from years ago. That was a federal incentive that was set up to get state investments in aid, and then there was a federal match that was there. When that program was eliminated, New Hampshire eliminated their component, and so there's no state financial aid in New Hampshire. So they represent that at one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, you see more states that have lottery-funded programs. So Arkansas is actually a good example of that. Between 2010 and 2011, there was a large jump in the funds that they had available through their lottery-funded state aid program. And so they opened up eligibility to adult students in some different and interesting ways. And that accounted between 2010 and 2011 for a pretty significant jump in expenditure. really the from all of that data, what I want you to kind of pull out of that is that states really do provide significant support for state aid. So in 2014, $11.6 billion went to 4.4 million students, and this isn't an insignificant amount of money. It's small compared to what the federal programs invest, for sure, but in terms of the assistance that are provided on an individual student level, these programs are really important, and so getting the design of these programs right, or as right as possible, is important. A lot of states, to that end, consider legislation surrounding state financial aid programs. In 46 states, at least one bill was considered in 2015 having to do with state financial aid. So you're certainly not the only state asking questions about your programs and what they're doing and how they're designed. If this figure should show anything, it should really normalize that these conversations are happening across the country and in state houses and in higher ed offices across the country. In total, in 2015, states considered a total of 265 bills related to state financial aid, ranging from 1 to 54 in New York. So they were pretty busy in the New York State House. But just to give you an idea of the conversations that are taking place, these are the enacted bills, so the states that enacted measures related to state financial aid. And again, you know, in 46 states, something changed with their state financial aid program last year. So this is a common conversation and something that ECS has been providing support with across the country. So I want to talk a little bit about what these bills really intended to do. What is it that states are trying to do or change with their state financial aid programs across the country, and how does that kind of stack up to the conversation that's taking place in Connecticut? This is just a word cloud of all of the bill texts across the country, so it just kind of makes the words that are in those bills jump out at you. So states are talking about students, they're talking about their different programs and scholarships and how to provide that support. By and large, the most common thing that states do with financial aid programs is create new programs. One in two bills considered in the states in 2015 would have created an entirely new state financial aid program. So when we talk about state financial aid redesign, it's really more of just designing from the get-go, and then states less often do they look back at what they already have and realign their existing programs. It's usually an add-on that happens. So far, we've got at least 17 new state aid programs that have already been enacted across the country just this year. And 16 states have looked at proposing changes to existing eligibility criteria across their programs. The reasons for this can really be put into four different categories. States find themselves in situations when recipients and funding really aren't meshing, when the right amount of money isn't available to support the students that they have. And there are four common responses that states make when each of these scenarios are occurring. So when normally what we see across the states is that when there's a lot of students to serve and there's a lot of money to serve them, we usually see a state introduce a new program. That's the most common response that comes up, is a legislator will start a new initiative, a new program will be funded and begun within the state. When funding is high but recipients are low, and this is much less common, we usually see states that will actually increase an award amount, so they'll give their existing students a little bit more, which rarely happens but does happen from time to time. Or we'll see, as in Arkansas, eligibility criteria change, so we're going to serve more students with the same amount of money. When funding is low and recipients are low, programs are usually unfunded or eliminated. Less often are they eliminated. They're usually just unfunded and remain somewhere on the books. And then when recipients are high and funding is low, we see that states are looking for ways to ration their dollars. How do we get the money that we do have to the students where it can have the largest impact for students? How do we take these limited resources and really make the biggest impact towards our state goals? Really, the hardest things are when those two pieces are out of alignment, and this is where states usually have the most difficulty with enacting effective policy, is when funding and recipients are out of alignment and we need to think of ways to get the right amount of money to the right pool of students, and it's usually in a fiscally restrained environment, right? We don't have enough money to do everything that we want to do, and so we need to find ways to align around some common goals. So to that end, the State Financial Aid Redesign Project is really positioned to support states through that process. Hopefully, if the previous slides have shown you anything, is that there's been a lot of change in terms of state financial aid programs. These aren't stagnant programs that just remain year to year without being questioned by legislatures. Most states look at these programs every year. And so to that end, this redesigning state financial aid project is intended to support states through that change process. And so what we did, where that report that you all have came from, I'm just going to take a drink really quick. It came from ECS convening what we call a thinkers meeting. So in December of last year, we took 12 experts on state financial aid. They're listed in the back cover of the report. And we pretty much just put them in a room and we said, if you were going to start over again on state financial aid and completely redesign how states provide financial support to students, what would you do differently? Would you do the same things again, or what decisions would you make? And this report is the product of that meeting. What the report does is it outlines four principles for state financial aid redesign. And I'll go through each of those really briefly, and then I'm going to talk about some recent policy actions in each of those areas across the states, and then we can pause for questions. The first principle is student-centered. What student-centered means is that state-funded financial aid programs that are designed around students and their needs have the greatest potential to set students up for success in their college experience. Really, programs should work with students. They shouldn't be a barrier to students participating in higher education. And so the student-centered principle just talks about considering the student first when you're developing policy. The second principle is goal-driven and data-informed. What this means is that state financial aid programs should really, to the extent possible, be united around a common goal. What is the state hoping to achieve with these investments in state financial aid? And then we can monitor progress towards those goals with different data points throughout. So how will we know when we're making progress, when we're not making progress, when we've arrived, perhaps, at meeting that goal? Without building into policy the right types of data collection or, ways to be informed by data throughout the monitoring process, that's not going to happen. So the third principle is timely and flexible. And what this principle addresses is when students receive their disbursements, how often they receive their disbursements of aid, and how much those disbursements are. So as I mentioned near the beginning of the presentation, students are more likely to be part-time. They also may be attending year-round. So to what extent do students have the flexibility to access aid for those different enrollment patterns? So the timely and flexible principle speaks to that. The fourth and final principle is broadly inclusive. The thinkers that we convened in the meeting believed that state programs could do more to include a broader variety of ways that students make progress towards a credential today. We know that more students are enrolled in distance education, prior learning assessments, competency-based education. And so thinking about ways that states can reward progress towards a credential no matter how it's made is something that was important to the thinkers that came around the table in our meeting. In terms of student-centered financial aid policy, these are just several areas where we've seen trends in the 2015 legislative session. If the policy is listed in green, it passed. If it's listed in red, it did not pass. So we monitor policies at ECS whether or not they pass. Student-centered financial aid policy that we watched over the last year had to do with simplifying application processes. So in California, for example, they're doing more to remove the responsibility for the student to actively apply for their Cal Grant. High school GPAs and FAFSA information are automatically matched by the Student Aid Commission. And then students receive a letter in the mail that says, you're eligible to receive state aid, and here's what it could look like depending on where you go. This could have a larger potential to influence student decision-making at a really key time when they're making choices about college. And so the steps that the state took to foster that process have been important there in California. States have also been paying more attention in the 2015 legislative session to foster care students, paying specific attention to students who don't necessarily have that parental support available in their lives. So we usually think of college as something that parents bear significant responsibility in financing, but that's not true for everybody. And so states have been doing more to be more inclusive to students in foster care in their state aid program. We've also seen a lot of states, and Connecticut is one of them, considering a variety of measures related to undocumented students. and opening up state aid eligibility in addition to in-state resident tuition to undocumented students. In terms of goal-driven and data-informed financial aid policy, we've seen a few different trends across the states, the first having to do with student information tools. So this idea that states should be providing different information to students about college and that this information would then somehow inform the student's decision-making process, perhaps helping them to make better decisions. Each of those measures that passed had to do specifically with student debt, so informing students about their loans earlier or about their potential repayments earlier in the process. States also have asked for different legislative reports to understand better what's going on with their state financial aid programs, and again, you'll see Connecticut as one of those states. Sometimes these measures, you know, most of them pass just because a report is pretty easy, but I think, you know, we just want to call attention to what's being asked for in these reports and what's going to happen with that information, and what are legislators or the requesting agencies going to do with that information once they receive it. We've also seen states looking at institutional eligibility a little bit different, so looking at specific data about institutions in order to inform their eligibility to participate in state aid programs. So in California, for example, they have statute on the books that if an institution's cohort default rate is above a certain threshold, that institution cannot receive Cal Grant students. And so that legislation has to do a little bit with that process of what that looks like. In terms of timely and flexible state financial aid policy across the country, we've seen states redefining award duration. So thinking about, you know, in most states, their awards are renewable from year to year, but are they renewable for a number of semesters or for a number of years? And what does that look like? Would that let students stop out if it's determined by a number of semesters, whereas if it's determined by a number of years, do students need to be enrolled, you know, in a consecutive term by term by term in order to remain eligible? We've also seen states rethinking some deadlines related to their programs. So in most states, students need to either file an application for state aid or file their FAFSA, their free application for federal student aid, by a certain date in order to qualify for state aid. And we've seen some states recognize that that can be a little bit inequitable in terms of the students that are funded by their state aid program. Often it's the students who have very strong college plans developed very early in the calendar year that are able to participate in those types of deadlines and meet those requirements. And so we've seen some states moving towards getting away from the focus on a deadline and moving more towards focusing on their eligibility criteria in order to ration dollars. We've also seen states looking at credit hour loads, and so there's been a trend surrounding defining full-time at 12 or versus 15 credit hours and how state aid responds to the number of credit hours that a student is enrolled in. Could it incent students to take more and to progress faster, or alternatively, could it provide that flexibility to enroll part-time for certain student populations where that's really a reality for their lives? Finally, in terms of broadly inclusive state financial aid policy, we've been tracking a few different trends. Two states considered legislation related to competency-based education in 2015, so these would have started completely new state financial aid programs specifically for students enrolled in competency-based programs. Both of those measures failed. In Colorado, there's a new program that did pass related to career and technical education, so it's specifically built for students participating in academic programs that are less than a year in length or not long enough to qualify for Pell Grant. So if a student would have qualified for Pell under all other eligibility requirements except for the program that they've chosen to use, Colorado would kick in some state aid there. We've also seen states looking at alternative eligibility pathways towards aid. So in many states, students need to qualify either based on FAFSA information, a high school GPA, a test score. In Ohio, they considered a measure to open up based on GED completion and those scores. So just different ways to open up that eligibility. And there is where I'm going to kind of just wrap up and leave for there. I think, I think the main points that I would want you to get out of this presentation is that all states consider these types of measures. This is totally normal that you're going through this process. These are difficult questions. These investments are important. And we at ECS are here to support you throughout this decision-making process that the Commission's been charged with. So thank you again for having me, and I wanted to remain available to answer any questions that you might have.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Sarah. I should say how we got here and why we're here. A few things came together, but primarily Connecticut has just gone through a strategic planning process, and we have now passed the goals in legislation and statute now that were determined to be what Connecticut should prioritize. So for that's why this is really a sub or committee or a working group off of the Planning Commission for Higher Education. What we're trying to do here, I think, is try to align the state's goals for higher education with how we do financial aid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much, I think, brought this to the forefront. There's been a lot of other issues that also came into play, how we do the Governor's Scholarship Program, how the issues of institutional aid came up and came under fire in this legislative session, where we've seen other states moving in the direction, I think, like Oklahoma, mm-hmm. Trying to eliminate or identify where institutional aid, you know, is going. And I can speak for myself that clearly is not a direction that one would want Connecticut to be going in. But I just wanted to give that background so you got a better handle maybe, and also from the participants, why we're here today,
mm-hmm.
And what we hope to accomplish. Thank you. But my first question, it really has to do with the one of the goals that we established was the need to increase the percentage of Connecticut's population that has a post-secondary degree, and we set a numerical value of 70%. We know in order to reach that goal, we have to reach out to the adult population. So even if we recruited every single high school graduate,
mm-hmm.
we're still not going to get the number of people that we need for Connecticut's workforce. Which brings me to the question of part-time students.
Mm-hmm.
This is a challenge because one of the things we have been made more aware of is the statistics are that part-time students are less likely to graduate. So I had initially been massaging the incentivizing by providing more financial aid to students to encourage them to go full-time. But at the same time, we understand the realities for the community colleges. You know, you want to make it workable. And I don't know how we balance that or what the solution is, but hopefully this body will take a deeper look at that particular issue in Connecticut. So just your basic reactions mm-hmm. to some of those comments would be helpful.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question. We've seen several states across the country really kind of double down on this idea that full-time students are the most successful students in higher education because the way that we've measured success is completion. And of course, when you earn more credits, you're going to progress towards that credential faster and you're going to complete within those time frames that completion is traditionally measured on, a 4 or 6 year time frame. That isn't always a reality for part-time students or for adult students. In Indiana, for example, they've started a very big push towards getting students to be in at least 12, but 15 credit hours in order to qualify for the full amount of their state aid. They're showing some really great early gains. But I think that when you look at the students who are able to participate in that type of enrollment pattern, that might explain a lot of those successes, right? And so those gains that they report haven't been controlled for things like student income background or student academic preparation or how old the student is or different things like that. So we've kind of, at ECS at least, started to interpret some of those results with caution. There are other states that take a more flexible approach towards determining their award amount. So in Illinois, for example, the awards, they follow a pattern a lot like the Pell Grant, where a student would receive, for example, $5,000 a year, and then that could prorate based on how many credits they take by term. So if you're going to be full-time in fall and spring, you could get $2,500 and $2,500. You know, if you're going to be part-time, you could receive maybe, you know, $750 for fall, spring, and summer because maybe you want to pick up some credits over the summer. So states have taken a variety of approaches to this. It just depends on the population that the student or that the state is looking to target. You know, in Indiana, I would say that they're really setting up a lot of their direct from high school to college population for success through this program. Those students are more encouraged to come directly out of high school into post-secondary to take their 15 credits and to finish on time. But the program is exclusive of adult learners and students coming back to college later in life. So you kind of have to weigh those two options in terms of the goal setting for your state and the populations that you're trying to reach.
Could I follow up on that?
Sure.
So, one, you know, clearly the 70% statistic that Roberta's citing is very key to us, and the demographics tell us that the majority of the students we're going to need to capture are those 25 to 45-year-old students, who my guess is they are working. So, in addition to prorating aid and credit hours, are there other approaches that you have seen that work for that particular population? I mean, yes, I agree that, you know, people that go full-time graduate faster, but some people just can't because they have to support a family or to support themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we haven't seen it specific to adult student populations, but across the country, I think across the states, there's been an increasing recognition of advising and student supports and the role that they play in helping students to be successful in college. I haven't seen states specifically tailor that towards an adult student population, but just in terms of general student populations, I think that those types of supports really matter in terms of overall student success. How to get registered for classes, how to stay in your classes, how to understand when you can withdraw, when you can't, getting registered for the next term so that you persist from term to term, all of those types of advising functions are very important.
Does anyone have a? I know I have a number of questions, so I'm going to let everyone ask theirs first. So, Jen,
how do you align or mesh the concept of student-centered versus aligning it with state goals? So, I mean, if you're, because I think of like a Pell is based on eligibility, but nothing else. And so, if we want to align it with state goals and workforce needs, how do you sort of align those two goals?
So I don't see the student-centered goal and the state goal principles as contradictory. I think that by thinking about the student first and setting that student up for success, that should directly feed into the goal that your state has for state-funded financial aid. And if those two things aren't meshing, then I think that there's probably a larger misalignment in terms of the state goal and the types of students that you're thinking about in terms of that state goal, if that makes sense, right? So if your state goal is completion, like it is across a lot of states, but you haven't done that work to recognize that you can't get there on the backs of high school graduates alone, then you're probably going to be a little bit out of misstep between the student-centered approach and your goal. But it sounds like you guys have done some good thinking already surrounding what types of students you're trying to reach, and so hopefully they're going a little more hand-in-hand for the committee moving forward. Does that help a little bit?
Sarah, maybe I misunderstood, but you seem to imply that states have a role in determining Pell eligibility. Did I misunderstand, or is there clarification there?
No, I apologize. I did make it sound like that. No, they do not. So Pell is something that's determined completely through the free application for federal student aid. I think I might have drawn a parallel between Pell eligibility and how states determine eligibility for their grants at one point. I apologize if that was confusing.
You mentioned that there was a state that potentially had a specific summer tier. for their part-time population, or at least it sounded like you said 750, 750, and potentially another 750.
Yeah.
Have you come across any states that come up with a summer tier for their for their grant population? I know ours is pretty much semester-based, and yes, if they haven't exhausted it, then there is some available, but it would be really interesting and very beneficial for my student population to be able to have an extra summer tier if funding is still available, things like that, so that they can continue their education, because the majority of students do exhaust their funding between the fall and the spring.
Right. Yeah, so there are two states that I've already alluded to that do allow for summer eligibility in two different ways. Illinois does it a lot like, for those of you who are familiar with how the Pell Grant works, it works a lot like Pell. So it would set an annual limit. So based on your criteria, you would qualify for a certain amount, and then you could draw down prorated amounts of that dollar amount throughout the year, depending on how you're attending college. And then once you've reached that limit, then you're done. So if you're full-time for two terms, then you wouldn't have anything left for the summer. But if you were part-time, in, you know, two semesters or in quarters or whatever else, then you may have something left over for the summer. In Indiana, where they've really doubled down on this 15 credit hours as full-time approach, they've defined it as 30 credit hours per year, academic year, that the student has to complete. So it still is possible that a student could receive smaller awards for 12 credits, and then 6 in the summer, for example. So they could choose to draw down their award in that way if that made the most sense for them.
Have you seen any of those states deal with accelerated programs? And I'm kind of thinking as we're talking here with that wonderful concept of year-round Pell. And I think year-round Pell through the federal government had its best use with the adult population who felt they needed to get accelerated programs or earn 30 credit hours, 24 to 30 credit hours, throughout an entire calendar year. In some accelerated programs. Have you seen any that might perhaps sponsor something in accelerated programs where you'd be able to gain your full-time credits throughout a calendar year? To me, that helps support the adult population who also have work needs and family needs, daycare and others, but also by bringing some of those in, do they also, within the funding, help support those programs, say, for example, bringing in students on a cohort that provides specific guidance, advising, and otherwise to get them in, through, and then out in a reasonable period of time?
Yeah. That was definitely a conversation that took place when we were crafting the timely and flexible principle within the paper. We've seen, and I think it's just a, it could be a symptom of a lot of different things, probably not the least of which is just states don't have a lot of money for these programs. So we've seen less, I can't think of a state example right now that has specific policy action targeted to additional summer awards to propel students in the way that year-round Pell seemed to be doing for the very short time that we had it. So I haven't seen specific state action, so I don't have an example for you on that one. And I think it's probably just a symptom overall of budgets and different things like that, and how so many states have award amounts, per student award amounts, defined within their statutes and regs and the way that works currently. It hasn't been changed very much.
Now I have a question. One of the goals, you know, to increase educational attainment to 70% in Connecticut. And by doing that, we know we are going to need students to get enrolled in certificate programs, right? We're now looking at 70% who are getting a bachelor's or an associate's degree. We have a workforce need in advanced manufacturing and other areas that are certificate programs. I know that the federal government has done, I think, right, some experiments now with the combination for the, I think it's the coding boot camps, if they're combined with that. But I'm just interested in what Colorado had done with their career in technical in allocating, I guess, money to, it seems like that would be more towards the certificate programs, and then how they define high need certificate programs, knowing that it's a set pot of money, right? And so when you're increasing eligibility, you're thinning out the money for other programs, but how do we target those that are in keeping with the state's workforce needs?
Yeah. Good question. So in Colorado specifically, they didn't specifically target those high-need certificates. It's just all those programs that are less than an academic year in length. And the measure actually just passed in this last session, so no students have actually, they haven't gone through the process to create the regulations and to actually go through this yet. I would be happy to find more information on it for you if that would be helpful, especially as their process develops. There are some states that have done more to target those high-need fields, and they'll usually do that by crafting new programs that are specifically targeted to only those fields. So the statutory or the regulatory language would say something about the types of majors or areas of study that, that were appropriate for that grant program. So there are states that, that do that. Colorado wasn't one of them who looked at it in that particular measure. And as they go through that process, I can continue to get more information for you all about how Colorado kind of feels that out.
How do some states deal with the issue of cost of attendance?
So some states, just in terms of how it's set, or?
I mean, what's the trend? I mean, because we used to have a program that took into account cost of attendance, of, you know, it was a separate program, so you could, the private colleges had more capacity to grant higher awards because they had a higher cost of attendance, and now it's all even. Right, exactly.
Okay. So in most states, in 2014, I guess, most of the expenditures that states had for state aid went into programs that defined financial need as cost minus EFC, right? So I think that in your new measure, you've got it specifically indexed to an EFC threshold, and only about 11% of the expenditures that were made in 2014 in state aid indexed eligibility in that way. So most states do define it as need. But a question that I get in the states that do that is how do we maintain any control over cost of attendance, right? Because a student could have a $40,000 EFC attending a $50,000 a year institution, and now they have $10,000 of need and could get state grant, right? Whereas you could have a student, you know, in a community college with a zero EFC who, you know, might not have those funds available to them, but arguably, you know, do they have higher financial need than that other student? It just depends so much on institutional choice. So there are some states that have exercised some level of control over the cost of attendance. Some states do that in terms of how the actual cost of attendance is set. So they'll give parameters to institutions in terms of what they can allow for the indirect components of the cost of attendance, things like room and board and books and transportation and personal expenses. They'll give institutions some guidelines for that. And exercise some authority over actually setting the cost of attendance directly. There are other states that, like Minnesota is an example, where institutions have the flexibility to set their cost of attendance where appropriate for their population, but the state will only recognize up to a certain amount in terms of calculating need. So your cost of attendance might be $40,000, but the state has said that for four-year private institutions will only recognize the cost of attendance up to 20. And so then when the institutions are calculating their actual grant amounts, they would only be able to go up to that certain threshold. To the extent that that controls tuition, actually tuition setting within the colleges is probably pretty null, but it helps the state to control a little bit of the amount of state grant that's going out across different sectors. Does that kind of make sense? I got a little bit in the weeds on that one. So
no, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I know that, for example, Cal grants are different. Also, they're within cheap, even yeah. just even the public, they're different. So it's like the flag, you know, the state universities are a certain amount, the privates are a certain amount. And I just don't know how those numbers are set, but that's helpful to hear. Mm-hmm. That's one way.
Question. You showed a chart that had the state aid by operating budget as well as the financial aid. Can you tell me, is there anything that includes, or have any of the statistics included, the unfunded subsidy for students in any of those states that might have done that? Mm-hmm. I'm saying, for example, a Connecticut resident goes to a Connecticut institution at a much lower cost than that same Connecticut resident would go to a private institution. And I don't know if there's any of that general subsidy funds gets calculated into any of that. Does it come under operating? Does it come under financial aid? Or does it not be included at all?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, because certainly, you know, when students are given a subsidized tuition rate, that is kind of indirect state support. I think states have taken some different approaches towards looking at that. Washington State, they do a little bit better of a job modeling out their data and including the general appropriations and tuition subsidies in terms of including that in state support, but there's no national data that I'm aware of that does that. There are other states that have really wanted to make sure that that state component, that state support, is really front and center, and that families know that in-state tuition is a form of state support. Colorado is one of those states where they're the only state in the country to have a voucher program that discounts in that way. So students actually have to sign up for a separate state voucher to get a buy down of their tuition rate in terms of it brings it down below the in-state rate. Other states haven't latched onto that type of model. I would say it's been met with some mixed success in Colorado, but the question is a good one.
As we head towards prior year and earlier application for FAFSA, have states looked at the timing of the allocation of funds yet? And are whether or not maybe even the allocation should come out a year prior, you know, indicating how much the fund will be an extra year out?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm actually we're writing a paper on that right now at ECS because when the prior year, so through prior year, students would actually apply for aid based on a tax return from 2 years ago. So it's more likely when they're logging on to the FAFSA that they'll be able to just immediately link into IRS data retrieval, complete their FAFSA quickly or faster, and then institutions might also have the flexibility to move up when they're admitting students, because the FAFSA form will actually be available earlier as well, as early as October 1st. And so immediately when that announcement came out, I was thinking of state budget processes, of course. You know, you may have the potential to do some different things earlier and project state budgets based on something closer to reality in terms of what you may see in terms of enrollment in that next year and financial need across those students. It's still really early. I know that some states are thinking about the implications of prior year for their budget cycles, but we haven't seen any action yet, of course. I mean, certainly when the legislative sessions start back up in January across the states, we may see more, but it's on a lot of states' minds, and I've talked to a few different states about it. It's on my mind, too.
Hi, Sam. Thank you very much. I think one of the great things is you're able to give us perspective, Connecticut versus other states. I have, a few questions. If anyone else has a question, just stop me, and you could jump in then. I was going to try to wait to the end to ask all my questions. One is regarding the administration of state grant programs. Mm-hmm. Are there any other states where the state grant programs are also administered by an agency that is a regulatory
Mm-hmm.
also a regulatory agagency?
Yeah, so it's actually a pretty common approach across the states. So in Washington State, for example, the same agency is charged with administration and with regulation. Colorado does the same thing, where the same agency writes regulation and then also gives institutional allocations of aid. So it's a pretty common approach across the states. There are other states that separate them both out. So like Tennessee, for example, they have separate agencies, a regulatory and kind of governing body for higher ed that does those types of duties, and then a separate aid commission. California is another example of that. So it's more common, I would say, across the states to see them housed within the same body, but some states do separate it out.
Thank you. With regards to California and simplifying the AIDS process, well, first, I guess California, the Cal Grant, is that an entitlement?
Yes, it is.
And that's the only state in the country, I believe, you are one of the few states where the state grant is an entitlement?
It's one of the few, yeah.
Okay. Now, do they have then a need-based and a merit-based component to the Cal Grant?
I believe there's a need, that's primarily a need-based program, yeah.
Okay. And my thinking just was with the simplifying. I think you had mentioned, I'm not sure if it was California you had mentioned they required transmittal of the GPAs, or if it was Minnesota, I think, or one of the others. But I guess my thinking is with Connecticut, with our governor's scholarship, we have the need in merit-based components, and if we required, if you have the GPA transmitted, we're starting to require every student in the state to take the SAT. We can automatically send the SAT GPA, and with the FAFSA being filed earlier, if that's a way of simplifying, I guess potentially simplifying the merit component of the governor's scholarship.
It could be, but it depends on how you're going to administer the aid. So if you're giving institutional allocations of financial aid, so for example, the state, like the Office of Higher Ed, isn't exactly awarding students directly, then you may not achieve a lot of efficiency there because the institutions would have a lot of that information, if that makes sense. But if you're awarding directly to students, and there's going to be a state agency or office that needs to determine eligibility for students, then those types of efficiencies might be something to look at. Does that make sense?
How many states are, like, I believe New York, they do the financial aid. Is it just through one? You know, the SUNY system has one office for processing their financial aid for the state schools. Are there other states that do that, or is New York unique?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think in most, but I would think that in most systems, each institution would maintain their own aid office. Is that?
And I had other questions related to, are there any states who are administering scholarship programs or some of their funds? I know you've seen like the Tennessee Promise, the Kalamazoo Promise, the different promises coming up where they're promising the two-year tuition, and it's become almost a partnership between state and private entities who will donate into this. But are there any places where they're using tax incentives to encourage private companies to donate into these foundations to generate or to increase the amount of scholarships that are available for local students?
So in Colorado, we've been tracking three different state bills that incented local action in terms of funding scholarships for students. In the last 2 years, we've seen three different examples of this in three different counties within Colorado. So Weld County is a primarily agricultural in the northern end of the state, and in 2015, the legislature passed flexibility for them to change their property tax so that families who donate towards this college-bound scholarship program could receive a credit on their property tax. And now all students from Weld County, regardless of where they go to college, will receive a scholarship. It doesn't look at financial need. It doesn't look at academic merit. It just looks at where you're born. So they project that based on those donations to the funds and then people benefiting from that tax credit as a carrot to do that, that they'll be able to provide scholarships to students from Weld County throughout the country. And it was state action in terms of giving that flexibility on property taxing that allowed that to happen. In the bill, any county in Colorado can do it, but Weld is the only county that has. A different measure that will be on the ballot in Denver in December does kind of the same thing. So what it would do is it would provide state matches to private donations to a scholarship fund. So when private either nonprofits or corporations donate towards the scholarship fund within the state, then the state would match the donation to that fund. And then students from Denver would be eligible to benefit from that if they attend school within Colorado. So we've seen a few different things within Colorado in terms of local action and states trying to spur that local action for funding college scholarships.
When I asked the question earlier about aligning with state goals, and you responded that completion goals and student-centered should mesh, I'm just curious on principle two and using data to inform the decisions. How have states done that? I mean, if our goal is completion and we have data on student outcomes, getting grant awards, how has that been implemented into policy?
Mm-hmm. It's been a heavier lift across the states. Minnesota has really done the most work on that end. So they appointed a commission 2 years ago to look at really kind of a performance basis for their state financial aid dollars and to look at specific criteria about institutions that would play into decisions about eligibility for state aid and whether or not that institution could participate in the state aid program. Their legislature asked them to do this, so there were two different reports that they issued over the last year, but nothing has actually been enacted on either of these reports, which is interesting. But they talk about using things like graduation rates or student debt levels or persistence rates in order to help determine how much financial aid, you know, each of those institutions would receive. We've seen less state action on that, but we've seen a lot of state conversations about doing that.
You mentioned that award durations is something that states are looking into. And with a higher population of transfer students coming in and with adult students, award durations are going to definitely be harder to track.
So
how have some states implemented award durations? Is this something that the state itself is tracking on these, or is this something that the institutions will have to monitor? And, you know, 600% Pell is monitored by the federal government.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good question. In states that have really strong student longitudinal data systems, some of those states are doing it. So they would actually tell the student, like in Illinois and in Minnesota, like you're done, like you're out of eligibility now. In other states, it's more of an institutional responsibility, and so then it gets a little bit foggier in terms of determining that year basis. And there's a little less clarity there.
One of our state goals is also affordability for students. And one of the things around affordability, we all hear of the student loan burden, you know, the debt burden when they graduate. In Connecticut, we are fortunate. We have one of the best, I think, state loan programs in CHESLA. There aren't too many others, supplemental loans that are as good as that program. But are there any states that are looking at tax incentives to help? And you just saw, you know, PricewaterhouseCoopers, they just announced they're going to be paying student debt, you know, down for their, to help attract the young graduates. Are there any states that are offering tax incentives to get companies to help pay down the student debt? And is there any, do you know of any anyone looking at that action on a federal level where it could become a, you know, like a cafeteria plan benefit? I mean, you can, I put money away for my son's child care pre-tax, but are they looking at that for paying back student loans?
I haven't seen incentives for companies to be doing that. I've seen some states look at legislation on their state income tax. So for individuals, you could receive state income tax credit for your student loan payments. Wisconsin considered a measure last year. I don't believe that it passed. And several other states did the same. But I haven't seen any exactly for companies to do that. That's a good question.
Just... anyone else have any?
You guys are putting me on the spot.
Questions for Sarah? Well, we've saved all the hard questions for Lauren. We heard it was her first meeting that she's attending. So, if you, Sarah, would like to introduce Lauren.
Yeah, so this is Lauren Cisneros. She's one of our new policy analysts on the team, and she's just getting a feel for state visits and presentations. So, you guys have showed her a tough one.
my last question.
Sure.
I promise.
That's okay.
Is,
that's why I'm here.
How can we work with you going forward? Do you have grant money to assist us in any ongoing way? Would it be, or are there other resources you can point us towards?
Yeah. So I would hope that this would just be kind of the start of a conversation. And as this commission, you know, continues its work, please do feel free to shoot me an email or pick up the phone and give me a call and see if you have any questions on how I may be able to support you. In addition to this project specifically was funded by USA Funds, but in addition, ECS actually receives the majority of its fiscal support from the states. And so Connecticut is a member of Education Commission of the States, and your legislature pays dues for that. And so we are here to support you in this process. That's part of our mission, to provide support to the states. So please don't hesitate to reach out as you have questions or as phone calls would be helpful or anything like that. I would be more than happy to provide that support. We have 50 state data, you know, across the country on how much states are spending on aid and how they spend it, and we're the only source of that information across the country. And so as that would be helpful to you, please don't hesitate to reach out.
Thank you very much. And obviously, Connecticut's economic and fiscal situation really points us to trying to do this low-cost, no-cost process. The goal here for this committee is hopefully to, by January, February, make recommendations for what we might want to start doing in Connecticut. And so it's a very small, you know, narrow time frame, but that is what ultimately we'd like to see happen here. There's been issues, as I said, about institutional aid. We've had issues about how we do, you know, our state governor's scholarship program, and is it really aimed at either one of those reaching our goals that we're trying to achieve here in Connecticut? If you were going to, so I appreciate your offer of support. I can assure you we will be using it. Maybe you could even come back again to Connecticut.
I would love to.
Okay. Get that in the minutes, Jean. But if you were going to point us in a direction, this may be really unfair, but if you were going to point us for next steps, what, and you're looking at 50 states, and obviously Connecticut, we are different in, for instance, our independents are here, you know, at the table. Connecticut really recognizes the vital role that our independent colleges play in Connecticut. We know they produce 50% of our degrees. We need them at the table. They need to be a part of this conversation. And, you know, they are graduating our students. And so we want to obviously encourage that partnership and do what we can to further that. I wish we had more money. But I guess my question to you is, how do we dig down? Where do we go next? What's the next conversation that you could recommend for this group in terms of where our next meeting should be, maybe, you know, in terms of agenda?
I think there's a lot of potential to consider. I mean, Governor's Scholarship was already a really big change, right? And so you went from all those very specific sector-based programs and already folded right into Governor's Scholarship, and that's already been a big change. And so I think, you know, there's part of me that says, you know, let's see what happens with that, right? Like, let's not, like, totally stir the pot too much before you move into the next year and see kind of where the Governor's Scholarship goes. I appreciate, you know, your remarks about being sensitive towards sector. Across the country, you know, private institutions play a very important role in terms of degree production. They received, you know, 20% of expenditures on state aid last year, and that's behind 60% for publics and then 16% in two-year in-state publics. So they obviously, you know, they're an important group to have at the table. The other unique thing, you know, that I heard in this committee that I don't hear in other states all the time is that you really recognize that you need to reach these adult student populations. And I think in many states when we have these conversations, they expect to get there on high schoolers alone, on those 12th graders matriculating directly into college. And so I think that's important that you've made that recognition early, that you need to be sensitive to different types of students and you need to be sensitive to the sector of institutions that you're serving through your aid program. So I would continue to encourage you to keep those things kind of top of mind as you move forward and think about what may be appropriate to change in the Governor's Scholarship given its short lifespan so far.
Well, you know, following up on that, that may be something we want to do. I mean, there's been several issues that have come up, and we need to continue that conversation with, you know, how the Governor's Scholarship is playing out, particularly with the independents, because that's been, you know, the biggest, you know, challenge for them in terms of implementing it. But just tweaking it in terms of adults, learners may be something we need to think about first and how we do that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the CCIC and Mark, you know, you speak for the Office of Higher Ed, you would know, you know, maybe that's a dig down with you to help us achieve that goal of looking at that.
Just I wanted to follow up on something that James said as well, too, that I'm interested in knowing whether or not you might be able to help us. This idea of creating change in tax policy for the corporate sector, I mean, I see that as one of the key alignment places for us from the strategic plan, which talks about building stronger partnerships with in regions with higher education institutions in the business community. That might be very helpful to us in terms of getting, you know, the business community on board. If they're, you know, if they have certain needs, then, you know, the issue is can they receive some kind of tax incentive. I mean, I don't know if that's biting up too much to chew, but, or whether you can help us.
Yeah.
I mean, we have our own reality checks in the state, but that might be something where we could look at how do you create a policy like that. Because we don't have new revenue. I mean, we've got to look at, you know, other ways that we're going to get it or we're not going to get there.
Yeah, and I mean, just because I haven't seen measures on that doesn't mean that they're not out there. So I can do a deeper dive across the states to see if those corporate tax incentive structures have been introduced or considered or enacted in other states and what those look like.
Mm-hmm. I might add, ask another question. One of the things that I found so interesting or thought-provoking is the spreading out of the award over the year.
Mm-hmm.
And that really applies to not just the Governor's Scholarship, but that's the institutional aid as well.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if I could ask the institutions, I don't mean to put anybody on the spot, but for instance at UConn, how do you make those institutional awards, and would this be something that you could do that, and the community colleges as well?
Typically, we utilize our full allocation for our students in the fall and spring semester, and there's nothing left for summer, which at UConn is a trailer. So,
and the community college, I always think that it'd be different there because actually spreading it out to me for a community college part-time student, that would be terrific if it could go into the summer. How would that play out for you?
I think most likely colleges would be interested in, the community colleges at least, would be interested in helping students to persist, which I think is critical, especially for part-time students, through the summer. But largely we're in the same situation, I think, as UConn, in that we have spent all the money during fall and spring, and that for summer students, typically all they receive is, you know, Pell Grant loans or something like that.
Independence, do you have any?
We have a very large non-traditional population, considering our total population. About 1,000 of our students are non-traditional adult learners, and out of 1,500. And our summer is our least enrolled time frame. We do treat summer as a trailer as well, but because we have students who start in October and January and March, there are many students in our population that still have remaining eligibility left over. So a summer tier would be very, very helpful if a student did attend even full-time, but part-time in the fall and in the spring, because they would still have some Pell eligibility remaining for the summer. Mm-hmm. And then we could couple that with their Governor Scholarship eligibility should we move in that direction, and even if they had exhausted their loan eligibility, they may be able to make a half-time credit load affordable with those two options open to them. So it is something that I would love to pursue in the future because I could definitely see my population utilizing that as an option.
Great. Thank you very much. That was helpful.
I think given all that we hope to accomplish in a relatively short amount of time, I know with the holidays it'll be tough to do two meetings in both November and December, so if we could try to get in three meetings between those. So now what days does this time work for everyone? The Thursday 10:30? Is it a hardship for, okay. So the next one, would you say 2 weeks?
Well, why don't we look at the calendar? I know that some of us will be available later in November. That gets really tough, so maybe we could try to pull something off in the second or third week of November. Maybe something earlier in December. So we'll play with that. James and I we pretend we're in charge, but really Jeannie's in charge. So. we're just creating an illusion here. So, again, thank you, Sarah, for coming, and we're going to have you back. So maybe we can try to work with your calendar as well to see where we are in the December or January meeting. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Yeah, thank you again. And I think to Judy's point that we do need to really innovate here, and that's what Connecticut, at one point, we were known for innovation. We led the country in patents per capita, so I think that we can definitely hopefully come up with a plan that works for us. And just to kind of echo, a number of years ago, I ran on the Connecticut College, their financial aid website, just talking about financial aid is a partnership. It's a partnership between the parent, the student, and the family. And I think the state aid here is a partnership, and I want to thank all the partners for being at the table today. So thank you. And I think Roberta has one more thing before we adjourn.
I just want to encourage people to email. You can email Jeannie if you have questions or things that you would like that came to you afterwards. But we really would love to have, don't wait to the next meeting to think about things or the next agenda. Put it out there. Carrie, did you want to say anything from the perspective of Office of Policy and Management and maybe what information you could bring to the next meeting?
Sure. I think the Office of Policy and Management could be very helpful in laying the groundwork for how our current student financial aid system operates. We'd like to talk a little bit about the funding history. There was a high water mark around 2007 for student financial aid when you combine all of the various programs, and we're not there currently. I think it's also important to talk about the sources of financial aid. Certainly the state aid is really significant, but also federal and institutional aid and the proportions for each of the systems in the state. And I think it would be important for us to hear from the Office of Higher Education so we could better understand what Governor's Scholarship is. And I think there are some misconceptions about it and what it isn't. So I think that would be a good way to maybe set the framework for the following meeting.
Maybe if you could work with James on putting that agenda together, that would be terrific.
Great.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Thanks again, Lauren. Thanks again. You escaped the hard questions today, but if you come back in January, we'll be ready for you. So we are.